You are listening to Faithless Brewing, a Magic the Gathering podcast for the Spike Rogue. Each week, we design spicy new decks for tournament play. We put our creations to the test and share our findings on the air. Coming up on the flashback, testing results with Vantress Gargoyle in aggro, combo, and control. Then on the brew session, we are firing up the Witch's Oven in Pioneer and Beyond. All of that and more is coming up on this edition of Faithless Brewing. Thanks for listening and enjoy the show.
Welcome to episode 31 of the Faithless Brewing Podcast. I am David Robertson, coming to you from Minneapolis. I am joined, as always, by my guy on the left coast, Mr. Damon Alexander. Damon, what's going on?
Hey, I'm back in Minnesota, trying to ease my way into GP Columbus. I don't want to do that whole two-hour jet lag shock in one go, so visiting the family here first.
After the GP, are you going to come back and do Thanksgiving at home? Or
No, straight back to Seattle. But I get to spend a whole Monday morning in Columbus doing who knows what there.
Sounds good.
So can't wait.
I have heard that Columbus is an underrated city.
Oh, okay.
Joining Damon in Columbus at GP Columbus Magic Fest Columbus, is it called now, is Mr. Captain of the Industry, CEO of the podcast. He is Caved In Online. He manages our Faithless Brewing Twitter feed. Dr. Schriever, what's going on?
Hey, I'm doing well. Yeah, we might actually be at Columbus by the time this recording goes out. So if anyone listening is at the Magic Fest or playing the GP or just doing the side events, come find us. Come say hey. I'll try to post on our Twitter where we're at. That's at FaithlessMTG. Yeah, we'd love to say hi.
Exciting time. So before we get too deep into the pod today, we had quite the spike in our viewership. We've been growing steadily as we record this. Like I said, this is episode 31. But last episode, we were over 2,000 listeners for the first time, which is very exciting. So welcome to all the new listeners. And we just want to kind of give a quick overview for people who are maybe new here. Each week, we sort of do a brief kind of check-in on the state of Modern and now Pioneer. We go over a brew topic we had from last week. So normally we suggest a card and brew some lists in Modern and Pioneer. We see how those worked out. And then we suggest a new card at the end of the show and some lists that we're going to try out in both of those formats. Welcome to everyone who's new. And Damon, you wanted to give a special welcome to a very select few.
Yeah, so we have a Patreon where people can help support the podcast. It's completely optional. We'll give a quick shout out to the new patrons of the week. We have John N., Matthew S., Paymon, and David H. So thanks for signing up. We've had some great conversations in our Discord, and we're hoping to see some of those faces at the GP.
Absolutely. Huge thank you to all of our listeners who have been supporting us these past 6 months, whether you're new to the cast or whether you've been with us since the beginning. We would not be here without y'all. And special shout out to our patrons. I mentioned at the top of our last show that we were closing in on an important stretch goal that will allow us to hire an editor to help out with post-production. And sure enough, y'all came through, got some new patrons. Some people increased their pledges. That support really means a lot. We're going to have to add some new stretch goals now. I think the next thing on the docket is to start working on some merch, get some swag made up so that listeners can represent for the Faithless family. Patreon.com/faithlessbrewing is where you can find all the details. We'll be posting updates there as we go. So if you like what we do and you feel like throwing us some support, we hope you'll check it out. So with all that out of the way, we want to do a quick check-in on our main formats, Modern and Pioneer. It was a quiet week in banned and restricted world. Nothing banned in Modern, nothing banned in Pioneer. Just all quiet all around. Except for all the other formats. If anyone plays those, I guess they banned something in pretty much every other format. I actually started to lose track. But Standard, they banned
Oko, Veil of Summer, and Once Upon a Time.
So they just took the Sledgehammer to Standard. Kind of a fresh start. Does this tell us anything about the future of the Eternal formats, Pioneer and Modern?
The statement that design was made to give was alarming in multiple ways. The interesting fact was that they had targeted to have a much higher powered Standard, and that's their goal going forward. The way that they actually self-analyzed their problems was such that it's clear to me they don't understand any of the mistakes that they made and that they're likely to repeat them. But I think the fact that they're targeting to have a very high powered Standard means that we are going to continue to see what you've kind of been complaining about, Dan, which is a lot of volatility in these Eternal formats, because very powerful standard cards, especially on the lower end of the curve, as we've seen, often have sort of unexpected effects in these and synergies in some of these Eternal formats.
Yeah, I mean, they kind of danced around some of these issues. They're like, well, Eldraine was at the high end of a high power band, but within the band, except for the outlier cards. And it's like, well, if you include the outlier cards, isn't it like above the band? And if you target the high end of the band and you have outliers randomly because, you know, there's noise in the game, it's not a perfect process. Will we continue to have these things? Some of these cards will get egregious enough to kind of get the Cataxian Probe treatment, but then some of them are going to kind of linger forever in our Eternal formats.
What is the Cataxian Probe treatment?
Banned in all formats, restricted in Vintage. Playable in Canlander.
Cataxian Probe was actually not that egregious in its own standard format. So in that sense, it's unique. These cards are both egregious in standard, right? So Oko is way too powerful for standard and possibly too powerful in other formats or whatever you want to say about Veil or Once Upon a Time.
Yeah, I'm steadily seeing more and more Oko in modern leagues. The standard ban, I think, brought down the price a little bit, and so now it's more affordable online, which is great for people who are going to play what they want, and a bad thing if you hate playing against Oko, because there's just a lot of it now. Sultai Death Shadow featuring Oko, Simic Eldrazi featuring Oko, Bant Snow Control featuring Oko. All these modern decks we know and love of the Death Shadow, Blue Eye Control, Eldrazi, Tron, like they're not just Oko decks.
I saw an Oko Jund list did well in the Modern Challenge over the weekend. It was just stock Jund, but with some Okos thrown in.
Yep, and the most terrifying thing about playing against these decks is not the rest of the deck, it's just the Okos.
Yeah. So a week prior to this, they banned Veil of Summer and Pioneer. The scheduled standard ban then happened this week, and I was expecting maybe some movement in Pioneer, but it looks like they decided to hold off, not just in this announcement, but they also indicated that they anticipate no changes in next week's announcement. Next week, of course, is Thanksgiving week, if you're in the US, where they've announced a bonanza of PTQs. I think there's a Pioneer PTQ online every day of the week, so I think they're hoping to get a lot of data from that, moving towards a more stable place with the Pioneer banned list, perhaps. Perhaps as a courtesy, they indicated in their statement this week that they anticipate kind of soft canceling that scheduled BNR next week as well. So it seems like they're happy with the current state of the meta.
Or the people who write the BNR updates are going home for Thanksgiving and will not be in the office on Monday.
It's also true that they got a bunch of data over the weekend. So they had the SEG Invitational, they had two PTQs, and although there are a bunch of powerful decks and a bunch of powerful cards that did well, there's actually a variety of cards you can play, right? So you can still play Thoughtseize decks. The best one seems to be the Mono Black Aggro, which we talked about last week, which had won the PTQ the previous week. There's a bunch of mono green decks or green blue monsters or even Gruul monsters. So those are basically Once Upon a Time Mana Guy decks. And then there are a bunch of Field of the Dead decks, whether they be Bant or something else. And then there's a bunch of like white blue tempo slash control. That kind of is the swath of types of decks you'd want to play. There's no like hard combo, and I think that's what they want. So I think they're saying, you know, at this point, this seems reasonably healthy. We're going to just ride this out. And if something establishes itself over the course of all these PTQs during Thanksgiving week, we'll kind of revisit. But for right now, they've collected a lot of data, and maybe this is their vision for Pioneer is being realized.
Yeah, it seems reasonable enough to me, like looking at the Pioneer meta, that it's at the very least, there's no like hyper outlier decks that are like way better than others.
No tier zero, as you often say, Damon. So it's like you can play Thoughtseize if you want. That's a reasonable place to be. I mean, you get to play the game, and you can play turn one Mana Guy if you want, and you can play turn one Thraven Inspector if you want.
Right. Of course, sometimes all it takes is a little bit of time before you realize that a deck you thought was tier one is actually tier zero. But so far, it hasn't seemed that way.
To me, it looks like the top two decks in Pioneer are this Mono Black Aggro and Mono Green Devotion. Maybe next after that is some kind of blue-white tempo deck.
There's like the Field of the Dead decks, there's the Is It In Soul deck, there's like the Team Lotus Box version of the Devotion deck that mixes in Hardened Scales. It seems like a pretty wide-open meta right now still.
So, David, I know you've been brewing a lot of new lists for Pioneer, and we're going to continue with that today with some new lists. As you're looking at this field, do you feel like this is something where you have your footing now? You know what to prepare for and what your deck has to be able to do?
Yeah. Now you actually, you know, sort of getting to the point of modern. You need to think about, you know, like we said, these kind of archetypal decks that are going to play turn one Thoughtseize, the mana elf, the sort of control shells. And you know what kind of cards are going to be in them generally. To the point now, you know, you kind of lose that magic of Pioneer where it'd be turn two and you'd have no clue what your opponent is doing. Now by turn two, like it is in modern, I could probably tell you most people's decks within like plus or minus 3 to 5 cards. Although I did just lose in a league just before this started to a Jund deck I'd never seen before. That was literally just like value Jund, like Courser, Tracker, 4-mana Vraska, removal. I didn't know that was a deck. There's still people surprising you, but most of the time it's like 2 turns in, it's like, okay, here's the cards I need to play around. You know, I know what decks have Stubborn Denial, what decks don't. So in that sense, maybe it's a little more stable for people who like running stock lists and making interesting, you know, sort of considered plays and keeps and all that. It's less exciting from a brewing perspective because we can't help but calcify our thinking a little bit. These are the cards that quote-unquote should be played in this deck and the hands that they quote-unquote should keep, etc.
So then just taking a quick look at Modern, which is the format that Damon and I have been thinking about as we're getting ready for the GP. The main tournament that happened in Modern over the weekend was the Star City Games Invitational, which was split format Pioneer and Modern. It seemed like quite a narrow metagame there. The top tier, I would say, is Grixis Death Shadow and Simic Urza decks of various varieties, with maybe a tier 1.5 or running close behind them Eldrazi Tron, which continues to dominate the challenges on Magic Online, and Amulet Titan. Those stand out to me as the four that I'm expecting to like face on day two of a tournament, let's say. Damon, has that been your sense of it? I know you've been testing a lot this week.
Yeah, I mean, online has been feeling definitely very different than the SCG scene. I'm really, whenever I go to a GP, I'm never really sure what to expect. The metas between like MTGO queues versus MTGO challenges versus Star City paper versus your local 1K paper versus FNM versus GPs, like they're all pretty different metas. Like I haven't seen any Tron in a while online, and I used to see tons of it. I haven't seen any Burn online, haven't seen any Jund online, but then it seems like they're still there in paper. It's just online really seems to be a big influx of Oko decks now.
Yeah, I've seen all of the ones that you mentioned, plus the Oko decks. So it could just be Modern continues to be huge. But yeah, the number and variety of snow-based, Oko-based, Urza-based decks, a lot of Mystic Sanctuary decks. I'm starting to ask myself the hard questions now in almost every matchup. Is this person going to start Cryptic Command Mystic Sanctuary locking me in the middle of the game? Where, you know, prior to that, you know, not that many decks were incentivized to put that kind of interaction in their deck. It's becoming more and more common. Mystical Dispute seems to have become widely adopted, something that, David, you predicted would happen way back in our preview season. I was skeptical. I was wrong about that. I think I vastly underestimated that card, the versatility it has in hitting any card type. Modern continues to evolve, and it's powering up. I was curious if they were going to acknowledge the state of the format in the BNR. There were, of course, no changes, and they said nothing about it. It's possible that the Eye of Sauron is just focused elsewhere right now, or maybe they're just happy to see how things play out.
Yeah, I mean, the weird thing is that these GDS lists that are doing quite well are actually just like GDS of a year ago plus one copy of Royal Scions.
A classic, as we call it. Never goes out of style.
Yeah, I think their sideboards are a little bit different. I've seen, for example, Drown in the Lock coming out of the sideboard or Mystical Dispute, but their main decks at least are mostly the same.
It's same with Eldrazi Tron too, isn't it?
Yeah, that deck, since the addition of Karn the Great Creator, has just been plugging away all through Hogak Summer, all through the Stoneforge Mystic experimentation phase. Yeah, it's still going strong through this Urza phase.
They change like 5 or 6 cards in their sideboard based on what other decks are good, and just like, all right, that'll do it.
The correct optimal chalice number has changed throughout the course of the year, but it's still one of the better Chalice of the Void decks. It has very few natural weaknesses.
Does Eldrazi Tron play Once Upon a Time?
No, Eldrazi Tron, for the most part, is straight colorless. Dismember will be the only colored spell.
Phyrexian Mana.
Green Eldrazi decks are adopting Once Upon a Time as a 4-of. Zemek Eldrazi would be the latest incarnation of that.
Yeah, I mean, there's never been a better incentive to splash than to be playing Once Upon a Time and possibly Oko.
Yeah. Final thoughts on these formats? Anything to watch out for going forward?
I played against the Bant Snow Control list that Mick Winsauce got second at the most recent challenge. I guess he split the final, so he tied for first. And that list was, it felt good. I mean, it has like all the new busted cards. It has Mystic Sanctuary, it has Oko, Mystical Dispute main deck, some Jaces and Ice Fang Coattles and Force of Negations. And so it's kind of hard to get your stuff to resolve. The things that do resolve might kind of have to attack into an Ice Fang Coattl. Anything that is better will just get elked or bounce with Jace. The deck felt pretty strong, and it comes out of the gates fast with the cheap counterspells or forces. I'll be interested to see how that deck performs going forward.
Are you guys both still thinking you're running Niv at the GP?
I'm pretty locked on Niv.
Thanks to the fact that I am flying to Minnesota first, I had to lock in my deck choice before I took my original flight. I actually went to SF first, and it was hard enough to pack for 10-day trip with just a backpack, and so I only really had room for one deck, and so that deck is Niv. Day before I flew out, I like 5-0'd a league with it, and so I was like, all right, locked in, and now I'm like 2-5 in my most recent set of matches. So if anybody has a Bant Snow Control deck I could borrow before the GP, no, just kidding. Definitely locked in for Niv.
Well, you got to get those awkward draws out of the way now, you know, and then...
Yeah.
Then you're due with the GP. It's pretty simple.
I mean, a lot of the decks that Niv preys on feels like they're just not in the meta anymore. I haven't had a free burn win or a free Jund win in a while.
Yeah, it's gotten a lot harder. We still have some things to hammer out in the list. I'm loving Utopia Sprawl, and I know, Damon, you're on Safe Right Quest. People in the Niv-Mizzet Discord... Many of them are high on Gilded Goose. Small decisions like that. We'll check back with you all next week on what we concluded. Should be an interesting weekend. Of looking forward to it.
Yeah, it'll be a good time. Win or lose.
Excellent. Looking forward to hearing the results. So that's kind of a state of the play of both Modern and Pioneer. And we're going to take a short break. And when we come back, we are going to discuss our results from last week's Brew Around card, which was the Vantress Gargoyle. And we are back. So as previously discussed, our card from last week was Vantress Gargoyle. So just a quick flashback for those of you who aren't playing this powerful staple of multiple formats. Vantress Gargoyle is one and a blue for a 5/4 flying artifact creature type Gargoyle. And unfortunately, it has additional text. Vantress Gargoyle cannot attack unless defending player has 7 or more cards in their graveyard. Vantress Gargoyle cannot block unless you have 4 more cards in hand. And it may tap each turn to put the top card of each player's library into their graveyard. So, Dan, this is kind of a card you had some interest in, and you had a bunch of interesting ways you thought you could kind of mitigate some of the weaknesses or emphasize some of the strengths of this card in Modern.
Yeah, the thing that intrigued me about the card for Modern was that in the Modern card pool, there are some great tools for milling the opponent so that we can meet that condition of the opponent having 7 cards in their graveyard. Potentially very quickly and reliably, in which case the Vantress Gargoyle becomes a 5/4 flying attacker for 2 mana, which is kind of exciting. That in itself might not be enough to carry a deck, but in conjunction with Jace's Phantasm, which is a 1/1 flyer for 1 that becomes a 5/5 flyer if the opponent has 10 cards in their graveyard, you now have a critical mass, in theory, of creatures that become these flying Tarmogoyfs, if you can find some way to mill the opponent. So the cards that come to mind for that, Archive Trap, Glimpse the Unthinkable, these are staples of the blue-black mill archetype in Modern. They're both very cheap. Archive Trap costs 0 mana if the opponent has used a fetch land, or you can activate it with a Field of Ruin. Glimpse the Unthinkable is just a blue and a black, and there are even some weirder options, like Chancellor of the Spires. If it's in your opening hand, you can reveal that, and that mills 7 from the opponent right off the bat. If you have an opening hand with a Chancellor, your Phantasm and your Gargoyle are almost ready to start attacking right away. That was a theory that we were trying to put to the test in a few different ways. The first build that I tried was inspired by this Turbo Gargoyle list from Jordan Boisvert at Modern Nexus. He had proposed either a straight mono blue build or a blue black build. After thinking about it some more, I decided that the card that was missing from both of those lists was Once Upon a Time. If I'm building around this package of 8 creatures that do the same thing, I want to have additional chances to find those creatures to start the game with them. The list that I tried started off with 4 Phantasm, 4 Gargoyle, and a single Brazen Borrower as a nice card that you can find off of Once Upon a Time later in the game. My mill package was 4 Archive Trap, 4 Chancellor of the Spires. Since that wasn't quite enough, I felt like I should include some additional ways to find the Archive Trap, so I played 2 copies of Trap Maker's Snare. That's 1 and a blue instant, lets you search your library for any trap card. And then on top of that, a Singleton Mission Briefing, which is like a Snapcaster for spells, but because of the way it's worded, it does let you pay alternate costs. So Mission Briefing allows you to flashback an Archive Trap or a Force of Negation for its alternate cost, which Snapcaster does not do. Beyond that, some Thought Scours, Serum Visions, then cards that will pay me off and help me catch up after I've expended all these resources milling them. So 4 Visions of Beyond, and in the sideboard I had it Into the Story for matchups where I would need to grind and a card economy might become more of a thing. So I took this list into the queues. It performed actually surprisingly well. I think I went 3-2 with some of the matchups just going beautifully. Like, I had some fast beatdown kills where, you know, I started off with a Chancellor and a Phantasm on turn one, another Phantasm on turn two, or a Gargoyle on turn two, and outraced their defenses. It's kind of hard to defend against those creatures apart from just having spot removal. I also won a few matches where I wasn't able to get there with creatures, but just the quantity of archive traps was enough to mill them out. I think I had a game where I cast three archive traps in the first three turns, and in conjunction with a Chancellor of the Spires and a Thought Scour, they were basically out of cards. That felt like it certainly had potential. It was working a lot better than I expected it to.
How often did you find that Vantress Gargoyle was not able to attack in a timely fashion?
That actually didn't really come up, because there are not very many Delve spells, and everyone is taking advantage of fetchlands. The graveyards filled up pretty naturally, and they stayed that way. I think there might have been two games where I had to wait a turn to attack with the Vantress. It was working. I mean, I'd paid the cost in deck building to put those enablers in. The matchups where I was struggling was when all of that work was undone by Path to Exile. And blocking was also not as easy as I would have hoped. Even with these Visions of Beyond, it was pretty hard to stay above four. For the most part, these were offensive-minded creatures. The other thing that I struggled with was that both of the matchups that I lost were to tribal aggro decks, a Spirits deck, and an Elementals deck, actually. They had Unsettled Mariner in both lists, which is weirdly, really problematic when you're trying to archive trap someone off a Field of Ruin. You just need so much mana to do that.
So instead of three mana for a Field of Ruin plus zero for archive trap, you now need four for field and one for trap?
Yes. That's if they have one Mariner in play, and they had several Mariners in play.
Yeah.
So partly smarting from those losses and realizing that within the blue splash once upon a time colors, I didn't really have much to fight off creatures. I went back for one more go with a Sultai version because I felt like maybe I needed to at least have the option to put Drown in the Lock and Fatal Push into the deck. Drown in the Lock seemed pretty exciting as a card that could fill multiple roles. If I'm ahead, it will protect my creatures with this counterspell mode. If I'm behind, it'll pick off whatever creatures are giving me trouble. It gives me access to all the black disruption. Fatal Push, main or side, Collective Brutality, for example. Glimpse the Unthinkable seemed like a card that I ought to try. I had been relying on Chancellor of the Spires for the first build. They were not so good in the sense that they're totally blank any turn after your opening hand. At that point, they're only good for pitching to force a negation. You know, I want to have more live draws, so I'll try Glimpse of the Unthinkable instead of the Chancellor of the Spires for this league. And I made a few other small adjustments, like I put a couple Hedron Crabs in, another card that Once Upon a Time can find, so that you have more chances to start off with a piece you need. You need two pieces. You need the beater and you need a mill piece. So I thought maybe Hedron Crab would give me the mill quota that I needed while also being eligible for Once Upon a Time. This time I went 2 and 3. It was surprising to me how much of a difference those small changes made. What I didn't really appreciate until I tried this version was that Glimpse the Unthinkable costs 2 mana, Chancellor of the Spires costs 0 mana, Hedron Crab costs a mana plus fetch lands. When you're trying to come out the gates fast with Phantasm, Gargoyle, plus cantrips, it's hard to find room to cast these mill spells in addition to that while also playing the tempo game. The best possible starts are Phantasm first, Gargoyle second, and then on turn 3 you start playing your mill spells. But that means on turn 2 you're not really getting an attacking with a Phantasm unless you got lucky with an Archive Trap. The second thing that I didn't really appreciate until it was too late was that if you're pitching a Chancellor of the Spires to a Force of Negation, that means you already got the use out of the Chancellor. If you're pitching a Glimpse the Unthinkable to a Force of Negation, it means you're not getting to cast that Glimpse, and that means you're not reaching that 20 card threshold for Visions of Beyond yet.
Interesting.
20 cards is still a lot. You have to actually hit them with two big pieces to get the Visions to be enabled. That being said, Drown in the Lock was very good, and I liked having access to the Fatal Pushes and the other things like that. I was not happy with the Crab, and I was not that happy with the Glimpse the Unthinkable on the whole. So for this build, I think, Damon, you tried a similar type of deck. Do you want to talk a little bit about how that build performed for you?
Yeah, so I tried a list that was based off of the article from Jordan Boisvert, Blue Black Trap. I had the following hypothesis that I was trying to test. I personally don't think a deck should try to win both milling and via creatures. Every time you kill them with combat damage and you have milled them more than it takes to turn on your Vantress Gargoyles, every Glimpse the Unthinkable after that point is useless. And every time you win by milling, every beater you're drawing are also useless. They're going to games where you mill them some and damage them some and then don't go all the way on either front and lose. What I was trying to test is, what if we do the following? Can we build a deck that really is just blue-black control with a few archive traps thrown in that enable Vantress Gargoyle, Jace's Phantasm, and Into the Story, along with Drown in the Lock, to make those cards super effective. And in turn, we have to play a few slightly clunky cards. Like, if you're going to build a straight blue-black control deck, you might not play Thought Scour unless you have, like, Gurmag Anglers, which I guess you could, and that's not crazy then. And you almost certainly wouldn't play Didn't Say Please, which is a new counterspell from Thorn of Eldraine. One blue-blue.
Hang on a sec. You're reading the card, which tells me you actually put this in your deck. I thought you were joking about that.
Dan, I countered your spells with it. We Didn't Say Please, one blue-blue for a blue counterspell, and then you mill the opponent for three. It's not like a one-shot enabler of Vantress Gargoyle, but it is a role player, you know, a couple of fetches, plus a Thought Scour, plus a Didn't Say Please, and you have a 5-4 beater. And the card is not embarrassing. I mean, it's kind of embarrassing, but people play 3-mana counterspells. They're the next best thing to Logic Knot.
Do they play 3-mana counterspells?
Just another Eldraine entry into the modern card pool is all I have to say.
Yeah, I think I was slightly confused because I was thinking that in Pioneer, 3-mana counterspells are basically the best in class. But then I got scared away from Dave telling me, we'll get to Dave's Pioneer thoughts on some of these strategies. But I decided to stick to the modern queues, and I think I took my Pioneer idea to the modern queues with Didn't Say Please. You know, I mean, people play cards like Archmage's Charm, Force of Negation, these 3-mana counterspells, and Didn't Say Please is like, it's not terrible. It's definitely a step down from, for example, Logic Knot, but it's not like maybe it is a huge step down.
Damon had a bit of a thought collapse.
Yeah, so basically the build has 4 Jace's Phantasm, 4 Vantress Gargoyle, 4 Fatal Push, 4 Thought Scour, 4 Drown in the Lock, 4 Didn't Say Please, a mini mill package of 3 Archive Trap to go along with Didn't Say Pleases and Thought Scours, 2 Visions of Beyond, just because actually you either cycle them early, or if you have a couple Archive Traps or 1 Archive Trap plus some luck, they're amazing Ancestral Recall level, but you don't need 4 of them because you can kind of either just cycle it, like you'll have one sitting in your graveyard for later with a Mystic Sanctuary. I didn't feel the need to play a full playset. And then Into the Story, a 4-mana draw 3 if your opponent has 7 cards in their graveyard, which is very, very strong. I had a couple Snapcasters, a Deprive and a Cryptic to work with the Mystic Sanctuary I played.
Into the Story is a 4-mana draw 4.
Draw 4, sorry.
Yeah.
Oof, yeah.
How did the deck feel, Damon?
It had games where it felt like super lean and pretty sweet, where you have these like awesome push, snap, push, and then you have like a single Didn't Say Please, and then you just like drop this 1-mana 5-5 flyer, do all that, and then like they play something, but you're holding up Drown in the Lock. And so like these threats being so cheap made it very easy to hold up the counterspells at the same time. And so as a result, never really go shields down while having these very strong offensive threats. So I was actually like super impressed with the deck when it fired on that axis. I actually only went 2-3 in the league. I beat Red Prowess, and I actually beat Dredge, weirdly enough. I thought I was like, this is this terrible matchup. But game one, I had 2 of my Archive Traps and a Thought Scour, and my opponent dredged a little bit. And then by turn 4, I just went trap, trap, Thought Scour, and then that was their library.
You didn't die from Creeping Chills when that happened?
They didn't have time to get damage, and I actually had a Vantress Gargoyle out to block their Amalgam.
Oh, it happened. We blocked with the Gargoyle.
Yeah, and then game 2, they had a kind of a slow dredge draw, and I drew 3 Jace's Phantasm. And those are some cheap beaters. Jace's Phantasm actually, I think, impressed me way more than Vantress Gargoyle did. So 1-1, it can at least chip in. Vantress Gargoyle for 2 mana is a little bit that much more expensive and slightly weaker to cards like a Braid. I literally never used the Vantress Gargoyle tap ability. Like, I'm not saying it's not usable, but it just never came up. My losses were to actually the Faithless Brewing Mirror against Dan, and I would say that I think my decks should be way better than the mirror, except Dan has a single copy of Commandeer, which completely blew me out both games. I decided not to play around it, but so it goes. In a battle where we're throwing draw 4s around, 1 Commandeer can really turn the tide of that.
Once I took your draw 3, I'd do it again.
Yep. I was not expecting it the first time and decided not to play around it the second time. Maybe I should have been more patient on that, but... yeah, so it goes.
That's the first time we've ever run across each other in the queues, actually.
Yeah.
I'm 1-0 now.
I know. I really do like my build more than yours, though, to be honest.
Scoreboard.
I lost to Blutron. They had Relic of Progenitus, which was a complete blowout. One problem with these cheap eaters is Blast Zone just completely shuts down Jace's Phantasm very quickly.
I had a similar experience playing against regular Eldrazi Tron. Game 1, they chaliced me on 1 and it was over. Game 2, they led on Relic of Progenitus, and then on turn 2, a chalice for 1. I looked at my hand and I was just like, good match. I'm never going to come even close to pressuring them.
Yeah. Game two, I was actually pretty far ahead, and then they triggered an Emrakul, the promised end, to take my turn. And I was like, well, look, my hand, I've like into the story, and like it didn't say please, and not enough mana to cast both. And I was like, okay, this like can't be that bad. I only have six mana. I like, you know, prepared properly. I like fetched first so they can't fetch and fail to find. We go to my turn under their control, and what is my draw but Collective Brutality? It's like, oh, really? Now is when this card shows up? So I think I was going to, like, had a good chance that match, except for that being, like, the one card to, like, that was really, really what I did not want to see there. Anything else, and they could, you know, they can cast Into the Story, syncopate it for zero, and counter it, and that's not great, but, you know, that's a fair exchange, and then I get to untap with a Didn't Say Please and, like, a creature.
I think we're setting a record for the most times that Didn't Say Please has gotten a shout-out in a modern podcast. You may be the record holder for most times casting Didn't Say Please in the modern queues right now.
Yeah, I mean, if it lets you, if it, you know, maybe that card is slightly below the curve, but if it makes Drown on the Lock reliably work, that card is actually like way above curve in terms of power level when it's active.
So, Damon, I know in addition to kind of playing that list, you also ran sort of just like a stock Dimir Mill list like people have been playing, just to see sort of, you know, without getting too fancy with Vantress Gargoyle, what does this list feel like?
Yeah, exactly. Before I wanted to get into the Gargoyle side of things, I wanted to just try a straight up Mill list. Typical Glimpse, Archive Trap, Mission Briefing, Visions of Beyond, Crypt Incursion, Mesmeric Orbs, and Hedron Crabs. The list felt, I mean, it's an interesting deck to play. It's worth trying once just to kind of expand your horizons of Magic decks. I will say I would not recommend it in a metagame with Death Shadow present. Death Shadow is a hard enough matchup for any sort of blue-black control-ish type deck. And when you make their Gurmag Anglers just completely one mana, no questions asked, and you make their Death Shadows 18-18s because they have no fear of going to two life, that's just a tough, tough matchup. I went 2-3 where I got completely smacked by Death Shadow list. I didn't pick up a single game against a Jund DS list and a GDS list. I lost a close one to D&T, more just to missing land drops. I crushed Eldrazi Tron, and I beat Red Prowess of all things, where it was pretty important to line up the Drowning Locks with the Bedlam Revelers, because otherwise that card is quite scary. Actually, I think I met a Mill achievement where they had 15 cards in their library, and they cast Bedlam Reveler, and I go in response, Sheldock Isle, Archive Trap you. They got a two cards and died to the Bedlam Reveler trigger.
That's awesome.
That was pretty fun.
Okay, so Dan, you and I had kind of postulated, what if we start out with this Mill plan in game one when most decks aren't interacting with it, and then we kind of, they take all the removal out because all they see is Mesmeric Orbs and Archive Traps, and then we try to kind of get them game two with these creatures that are now turned on by all of our Mill. And you took a list that had sort of that concept into the queues as well?
I did. Kind of the culmination of all the modestly or unsuccessful lists that we've been trying. Despite the struggles of Vantress Gargoyle Phantasm, some of the cards that we were playing felt super powerful. Namely, Into the Story, Mystic Sanctuary, Drown the Lock, Force of Negation, and weirdly enough, Archive Trap. The thing that stood out to me the most from the two sort of flying Tarmogoyf lists I tried was how it was possible to win with just Archive Traps, not even needing a Chancellor of the Spires or Glimpse the Unthinkable. When I think about the stock blue-black Mill, and I look at this list you're describing, Damon, you know, Hedron Crabs, Mesmeric Orbs, Glimpse the Unthinkable, those are kind of like dead cards in a sense. You don't need to mill them for 100. You just need to mill them for 40. The stock Mill is built to be like a speed deck, so it has all these additional copies of Mill for a bunch, kind of like a burn deck, but it also has to pivot to this control role in some sense. So I thought, well, what if we just forget about speed, right? I'll build a control deck that intends to win by casting Archive Trap 3 or 4 times. That is actually a pretty compact win condition, and it just so happens that Archive Trap is A, zero mana most of the time, and B, works beautifully as an enabler for Into the Story and Visions of Beyond. So the deck that I ended up with had all these free spells, right? I had 4 Force of Negations, 4 Archive Traps, and a couple Trap Maker Snares to find them. That was actually my kill condition and my card advantage package at the same time. And the rest of the deck was all control elements. Some cantrips, but then the Drown of the Locks performing double duty, Counterspell Terminate, Fatal Pushes, and Cryptic Commands to complete a Mystic Sanctuary lock. This deck actually felt weirdly powerful. I ended up going 4-1. The loss was to Eldrazi Tron, but the other matchups were, they ran the gamuts, including this mirror match that Damon was describing earlier. So I didn't even have creatures in the main deck in that matchup, which is why perhaps I always had more removal than you did. But I played against Burn deck. I played against Death Shadow. I played against this Pioneer-inspired Green Devotion list that Brian Gottlieb was talking about on the Arena Decklist podcast last week. Yeah, it was easy to just control them out, easy to draw a bunch of cards. I had all these Ancestral Recalls or draw fours in the deck. And then probably two of the five matches that I played, I found that I did want to side in this beatdown package. Like Dave was describing, I had four Jace's Phantasm and two Vantress Gargoyle coming out of the sideboard. So like I played the match against Death Shadow. Game one, I just had so much card advantage and removal that I was able to kill all their threats. And game two, I figured they were going to slide out all their removal, which they did. So I just got them with flyers. I mean, I don't know how they were feeling, but they looked pretty helpless. Beat them for 10 in the air after they did 10 to themselves. So yeah, this was actually a pretty encouraging and really different style of deck than what I thought might be possible. Just the quantity of draw threes and draw fours combined with counter spells that you can either pay zero mana for or pay a bunch of mana for. This is where that Commandeer is in this deck. And then, of course, the Mystic Sanctuary locks. Like, it all seemed to work really well. I would change some of the cards. The Chancellor of the Spires were completely useless. I don't know. They shouldn't be in there. And I maybe should have diversified my main deck effects. I needed a bounce spell and maybe a life gain spell. And maybe an Archmage's Charm. But yeah, I think there's actually something here. I might play this one a little bit more just to get more of a feel for it going forward.
Yeah, the list looks pretty good. I mean, I'm surprised you're only running 18 lands in this kind of control deck. How did that work out for you?
It's great. 18 lands, but if you sort by mana cost, there are a bunch of zero mana spells and then a bunch of cantrips, four Opt, four Thoughtscour, four Visions of Beyond.
Yeah.
And then you have the London Mulligan, so you're never that far away. Because I'm playing four Visions of Beyond, three Into the Stories, I can recover from a mull to five pretty easily. By the mid-game, I'm discarding to hand size. You can go from zero cards to discarding to hand size pretty reliably when you have the ability to always find a Mystic Sanctuary to get the Into the Story back on top of the deck. And that was coming up a lot because I would just need to spend cards, like throwing cards all over the place for these Force of Negations, with the expectation that I would get them all back, which worked out pretty well.
What's the takeaway you guys had? It sounds like you guys were a little intrigued by mill packages in general, or some of the cards to do with mill, and Vantress Gargoyle itself was okay, was somewhat functional, but not worth the juice wasn't worth the squeeze, as my father likes to say.
I agree with what Damon was saying. Jace's Phantasm was a much better version of Vantress Gargoyle for numerous reasons. It always blocks. It's one mana. The way that you constructed your deck, Damon, to actually hold the Phantasm until like turn three or four, just keep counterspell mana open. That's something that the Phantasm could do and the Gargoyle really can't, because the Gargoyle is not really a blocker that stabilizes you. The beatdown plan is effective when the opponent is not removing your creatures, but it's a little bit too much to ask to protect your creatures while also enabling them, if that makes sense.
Yeah, I'd have to kind of try your list, Dan. Basically, you managed to avoid playing cards like Didn't Say Please at the expense of having to play more dedicated mill cards. On the flip side, you also don't have to play creatures at all. It's an interesting trade-off to be making there.
Well, it was something that I was initially resisting because I wanted to see what Vantress Gargoyle could do, but I was just getting frustrated by how easily any deck with Fatal Push or Path to Exile could just undo all my work, essentially.
The efficiency of one and two mana removal spells means like the size of a creature is very little, other than Bolt, is very little to say about if it lives or dies. I mean, Abrupt Decay and Fatal Push just check casting cost. You could play a one mana million, and it dies just the same.
Yeah, it's weird to contrast these one mana 5/5s against like Niv-Mizzet, who's a 6/6 flying dragon. It's weird that Niv-Mizzet is incredibly durable on the battlefield.
Oh, yeah.
Compared to these like one mana cards, just based off like, yeah, the casting cost. They're both equally vulnerable to being Elkified, of course.
Right. I thought the comparison you made to Gurmag Angler was really interesting. They both require enablers, but Gurmag is so much more durable.
But I mean, the idea of just winning with four archive traps, that's very interesting.
Yeah, that I thought was really promising.
My one concern with these sorts of decks is that Rest in Peace is like a serious problem card. It turns off all your Drowning Locks, all your Mystic Sanctuaries just become islands. Into the Story becomes pretty bad. Mission Briefing becomes a blank. Visions of Beyond becomes pretty terrible.
Correct. This deck that I've constructed here has nothing to say about Rest in Peace besides hope to counter it. Yeah, so I guess takeaway is that Vantress Gargoyle is not really the star of these decks. If anything, it's maybe a bit role player in small numbers. But the other cards, Drown of the Lock, Archive Trap, Jace's Phantasm, weirdly, Into the Story, these are the ones that are on the modern power level. So explore those as your core going forward, and there might be something there. So that's modern, where we have these exciting tools. Pioneer, I think, was a bit of a tougher row to hoe, I guess. David, you took some Vantress lists into the Pioneer Leagues. Do you want to take us through your findings?
Yeah, so I proposed a bunch of different kind of shells you could use it for, just sort of theoretically, and I pulled up a few of them, just like a blue-black control list, right, with some amount of Vantress Gargoyles. and you just draw a few sample hands and play a few goldfish turns and realize you just cannot play Ventress Gargoyle on these lists. The list that I thought had the most promise was basically like an Emry Ascendancy deck. So it plays Emry, Lurker of the Lock. We've talked about that several weeks. And it plays Jeskai Ascendancy. Those two cards can form an infinite combo, even in Pioneer. You don't get all the sweet free spells, but if you have two Mox Ambers and a Jeskai Ascendancy and a Emry in play, or one Tormod's Crypt, you can go infinite. So you make your creatures infinite, and you can make infinite mana if you have the two Mox Ambers, and we play one Walking Blista to find with the Ascendancy. So the thought there was, if you kind of half go off, if you don't quite have the combo, but you've got Ascendancy in play and you cast all these little artifacts, you basically pseudo loop with Ventress Gargoyle. It fills up your graveyard because we're playing four Treasure Crews, and then each spell you play untaps it, so you mill them enough to get in there. What we found was basically that Ventress Gargoyle just blocked, and it was a reasonable blocker because Treasure Crews times four does, they either stick in your hand or you get to cast them and they refill your hand. So it did block. It was good against certain cards, but against huge swaths of the field, you just had to side them out. And it's a very frustrating card to play because if it's a deck that's going over the top of you, like a Field of the Dead deck, then you don't want to just sit on this 5-4. It doesn't do anything. If it's a deck that's playing their own Delve cards, you don't want to play this 5-4 because it doesn't do anything and you can't ever activate it. It actually helps them. It gives them mana. And if they're playing anything that comes back from the graveyard, you can't play Ventress Gargoyle. And then they don't play a lot of cards in the graveyard. There's no fetch lands. It was just a dead card a lot of times, and it was really frustrating. So we started with four. I was playing this deck quite a bit with Rhett, who's a friend of the pod. We started with four. I just hated the card. We cut down to three. We cut down to two. We were placing them with Golden Eggs as sort of a better value engine if you get Emry out.
Oh, no.
Yikes.
Oh, that's a sad day.
The deck itself was pretty sweet. We had a bunch of turn three kills. Basically, the deck can't ever beat Oko because it's just like a repeatable way to stop Emry. But it was okay against sort of like more removal heavy decks because you have a bunch of ways to recur Emry. I don't know if the weaknesses of the deck are solvable, but you can do some crazy things like winning on turn three. First of all, opponents got really mad. They always made us combo. They never threw down.
Wow.
They were so salty. Like the first few times we did it, I was like, oh, everyone threw down. It's like, oh, nice. This is going to be nice. We played three or four leagues, and it was just me going, like, how much mana do I need to, like, get this Ballista big enough to kill all their blockers so I can attack with my Emry? I've effed up the combo a bunch of times, so, like, I went to combat with only, you know, 18 power instead of 21, and they got another turn.
Yeah, these combos are rough.
It's a lot of clicks. I even had a list of dudes. I was like, dude, I will call you out on my podcast, and then I lost it, so you guys are all off the hook. So this is fun. We'll post this list. If people have recommendations to improve it, I would definitely be open to them. When it does its thing, it feels awesome, but it doesn't have a lot of interaction. And if you lose game one, it just feels so terrible because they're going to bring in all this hate for what you're doing. So Ventress Gargoyle there was at least did something. It was very mediocre. If I got to make the list my way, I would play zero.
I noticed you're playing two Teshar, Ancestor's Apostle, which I'm always excited to see. Ever since we tried it in, I think, the Kethys lists?
Yeah, this card was sweet. So, you know, decks play Murderous Rider or whatever. Mono Black doesn't have that many ways to turn on their own Fatal Pushes. So they have, like, four cards that kill it in the whole deck. And they are going to draw, like, maybe one, maybe two. So if they kill it and you play Teshar and get it back, they have to kill Teshar first. So now they have to draw, like, two more spells. They have to draw three of their four Murderous Riders to stop your combo. Yeah, it feels great. Fatal Push is not that good in Pioneer. It's really hard for a lot of decks that play it to actually kill a creature with three toughness. And decks that play Shock have kind of been chased out of the format. So the main card you're weak against is Oko. Unfortunately, Oko is, I don't know, a top five-ish card, maybe higher, maybe lower, depending on what you think. That's very hard to beat. But the Teshar list really puts black decks in a bind, and you do play a lot of black decks in the queues after the performance of Mono Black aggro.
What you were saying about gradually decreasing the number of Ventress Gargoyles in the Ascendancy list, that makes sense to me. It's a little bit sad. One of the people in our Discord, Mr. Ryab, posted that he actually had played a ton of Emry Ascendancy with Gargoyle 15 leagues or so when Pioneer first launched, and had a similar trend where he started with a full set of Gargoyles and they just gradually decreased down to zero in the end. He said that the list ended up being about 50% for him. We'll post that link as well. It's an interesting take on the build.
Yeah, the problem is the card is good against certain cards. Specifically, it's great against Smuggler's Copter, which is one of the more powerful cards in the format. But those decks also play Thoughtseize. So if you leave yourself with four cards in hand and they play Thoughtseize, you're playing on blocking, all of a sudden your card is literally no text. That happens so many times. And you need to play out your like third land. That seems like a reasonable thing to do. But they're also shock lands, right? When you're trying to combo before you die, you're incentivized to play them a turn early, tapped, so you don't have to take the two damage. So you can never leave yourself at four, and I've been Thoughtseize twice down from five. The Gargoyle's weak against this huge spread of cards. Any Delve spell, any Thoughtseize deck, any deck that can go over the top of you that you need to kind of race, it's bad against all of them, and that's a ton of decks.
Yeah, it just felt like Vantress Gargoyle is like a bit of a miss design-wise. Like, the numbers are not quite there to be constructed playable. If you just remove the blocking clause completely, the card would become better but not overpowered. And it just has like this attacking threshold, and it's just like at least a reliable wall. The four card threshold is just kind of strange. The fact that it mills one at a time, maybe if it milled like two or three at a time, it would be able to turn itself on in a couple turns in the worst case, but it doesn't seem to check the boxes for constructed very well.
So not to be undaunted by my Emery Ascendancy list failures, I went like 3-2 in most leagues, so it's not like it was terrible, but you just have to, you're just looking at your opening hand hoping you can win before you ever have to cast a Vantress Gargoyle. So I decided what I liked about the God Pharaoh's Gift we had played 3 weeks ago now is when the God Pharaoh's Gift does its thing, it's really hard for fair decks to beat you, and the matchup spread right now is reasonably favorable against it. Mono Black cannot interact at all with God Pharaoh's Gift. So what do you do against all the other decks where they are going to bring in Rest in Peace or Scavenging Ooze or whatever after board? And my thought was I wanted to have a fair game. So one of the best fair things to do is play Kiora and Glorybringer. Those two cards we've seen interact multiple times. Glorybringer also draws. It helps you try to find your combo if you need it. You can almost side out some or all the combo. So one of the things that I wanted when I would try to like side in this fair combo was more time, because they're attacking you with their 2/2s or whatever, their Scavenging Ooze, and you just start to run out of times you try to get to your five mana. So Vantress Gargoyle played a really interesting role there. It triggers Kiora, which is nice, so it kind of adds a card back to your hand to help fulfill its clause, and then it can actually mill two cards a turn, which is relevant in a deck that's hoping to cast Refurbish on God Pharaoh's Gift. Again, I never actually got to attack with this card. It was very good at blocking. That's enough if your end game is actually powerful enough. So the ability to refurbish all in the same turn, so the artifact you're going for is sort of Jace-proof for one turn, was very important. And it did an awesome job blocking cards, like I said before, Smuggler's Copter. It blocked all the energy creatures, Double Strike.
Electrostatic Pummeler.
Yeah, Electrostatic Pummeler deck. Yeah, so it's huge, right? It stops Cub. They have to spend all this energy. They have to spend an extra energy if they harness the lightning it. It was actually pretty sweet in that list. It was a way to start find hits in your graveyard if you are going to cast God Pharaoh's Gift. And you don't need so many cards in your graveyard, you just need the right cards. Just putting generic cards in there, you just want creatures at a certain point when you have God Pharaoh's Gift in play. So yeah, that list felt well. I was 3-0 in the league, feeling pretty good. Ran into just some mana issues in the last two games, but the deck still felt like reasonably powerful. I think I went 1-2-1-2 to finish 3-2, but the deck felt reasonably powerful. I think there's something to this shell. It's worth exploring. I'm not sure you need all four Vantress Gargoyles. I sort of played that in the name of science. Maybe a couple of them are worthwhile. But just the ability to transition back to that fair plan with the Kiora Glorybringer was nice. They're bringing in all these cards that don't do much against you once you abandon the graveyard, and you still get to do something that's very powerful in fair games.
When you say that you never attack with a gargoyle, is that because you couldn't attack or because you just never wanted to?
Could not attack. There was not a single time I could actually attack with a gargoyle.
Because you weren't filling their graveyard with stuff?
Or? Yeah, wasn't filling their graveyard with stuff. And then again, against a bunch of matchups where they cast a lot of spells like control decks, you just can't keep it in. They have two dig through time at least. If it's Phoenix deck, they have four Arclight Phoenixes plus four Treasure Cruise. I mean, it's just laughable how bad this card is. Yeah, it blocks Phoenix. That's great. But they play four Lightning Axe, which just dies to their one mana spell. Size doesn't matter, and they want to bring in a braid against you to kill your artifact, so the matchup spread is still very frustrating. You just have to side it out all the time, even if quote unquote it would be fine in the right matchups, but against decks like Mono Black and stuff like that, it's still reasonable to bring in. But again, if you mulligan on the play and then they Thoughtseize you, it's almost impossible to block with this card. So like Damon said, they really wanted to make sure this card wasn't broken, and they definitely succeeded in that.
Another successful.
If they're shooting for all 7 out of 10s in the Vantress Gargoyle was a nice little 2 that.
So you ended up going with the refurbished God Pharaoh's Gift package as opposed to the Gate of the Afterlife build.
Yes.
The difference being that refurbish, you need 4 refurbish for God Pharaoh's Gift. And possibly like discard outlets if you draw the God Pharaoh's Gift. With Gates of the Afterlife, it's a 6-card package typically, 4 Gates and 2 God Pharaoh's Gift.
Yeah, I wanted to cast Refurbish so that I didn't have this 3-mana artifact in play that was going to be vulnerable. It's vulnerable to multiple cards that are commonly played that aren't normally good against your actual package. So for instance, Abrupt Decay is great against a 3-mana artifact. It basically has no reasonable targets in our other deck. Like, are they going to kill your Vandra's Gargoyle, your Thraven Inspector, and then Oko. So Oko stops that artifact if it begins to matter. The refurbish method means you always get one activation because Oko's sorcery speed.
Right. Yeah. And second question, you mentioned this specifically Vantress Gargoyle being able to block Smuggler's Copter, which seems to be one of the most played cards in Pioneer right now. Do you find that aerial combat, so like having a flyer, is important, or is it just a question of stats? Like, are most of the creatures coming at you on the ground, or is there actually a sky battle going on in Pioneer?
The only flying creature of relevance is Smuggler's Copter, but it's everywhere. It's okay against spirits. I think that deck is something people thought would be good, and it's like a tier 2.5. You can play it, it's a fine deck, but Vantress Gargoyle is quite good against that deck. But the card that brings home the bacon in a lot of these decks is Smuggler's Copter. It smooths draws. Even Spirits, I think, plays it, even though it doesn't have any synergy at all. And it's a card you basically prevent them from attacking with. And Mono Black has to attack with this card. Otherwise, their draws get clunky. Turns, you know, late game Thought Teases into literally anything else. So being able to stop that is very relevant. And Glorybringer can't kill it, so you need a way to deal with it.
Question. I watched Minguchi's Pioneer video featuring a God Pharaoh's Gift video, and so spoiler alert, if you haven't watched his video from around 10 days ago or whatever, I'm going to completely ruin it for you. He goes 0-3 drop, never gets to refurbish God Pharaoh's Gift once. The one time he does, he's at like one life against a bunch of creatures and gets a creature in play and dies. It seemed like his opponents were well prepared in the form of either having counter magic for the refurbish, having a braid for the God Pharaoh's Gift, having Scavenging Ooze, or Rest in Peace. Were you able to get it to work at all?
Yeah, like I said, the plan game one is very reasonable. There is a lot of hate, but not in game one. You know, I think maybe some people are playing like one Ooze main. But now that Phoenix isn't very good, you know, I think people thought, well, maybe this card's going to get Treasure Cruise broken. If you see blue-red Phoenix top 8, any of these PTQs, that's a surprise now. So without the hate, it actually gets there. And again, you're playing cards like Glorybringer in a deck with Kiora. You can just literally turn 3 Kiora, turn 4 Glorybringer, attack with it. I intentionally designed the deck to have a much more reasonable fair plan. A lot of his hits are 7 or 6 mana cards are just so much harder to hit than 5. And Kiora is functionally a ramp spell, so I was playing more mana sources. And then game 2, because you have this Farish plan, you can also bring in Chandra. Chandra's a ramp spell to your bigger hits if you want. You don't have to refurbish. Chandra, a land next turn, just casts God Pharaoh's Gift straight up. And you just overload their counter spells. Counter spells are not very good in Pioneer, so they can't play that many. And so they're relying on Planeswalkers a lot, but Planeswalkers always give you that one activation of God Pharaoh's Gift. So they have their Teferi up or whatever, and you just get your God Pharaoh's Gift one time, kill their Teferi, you know, then they Wrath or play 5-mana Teferi, kill your creature. You just keep getting these extra activations, and so it's like a very tempo-positive way to attack.
So your final assessment of Vantress and Pioneer, then, is that attacking with it sounds like it's not a realistic expectation.
Yeah, so you have to play Vantress Gargoyle in a way that, for some reason, you think you're going to go over the top at some point. This is a card that lets you buy that time. If you can gain synergies from the mill, that's all's the better, but I think there's better ways to do that with 2 mana. Just a straight removal spell, something like Abrupt Decay, is probably a better defensive play anyway. So I'm not saying it's totally unplayable. If you're going to use it in that way, it at least has some text. But even there, it's quite mediocre. I don't think the ideal build of any deck is going to have Vantress Gargoyle in it. That's my takeaway.
So if you have an idea for a deck with Vantress Gargoyle and you want to turn it into its ideal version of that list,
yeah,
your first step is clear.
Yeah. Go to the 2-mana slot, delete 4 of those cards and play, you know, 4 Once Upon a Time or something else and then reconsider.
Yeah. I'm not going to disagree with that. That sounds about right.
It was a fun card to like get frustrated at, sort of laughing at how ridiculous these situations are. You're like, well, if they play a Thoughtseize here, 2 of my cards in play no longer have text. And they're like, Thoughtseize. You're like, yep. Spent 4 mana, literally got nothing. Can't block, can't attack, can't mill them. Because, like, you freaking mill a Scrap Heap Scrounger. It comes back on their EOT. They Thoughtseize you again. You can't block again. It's like, well, only so much help I can give my opponent before they decide to just do lethal damage to me out of mercy.
Yeah. The card is a little bit better in Modern, but it feels like Jace's Phantasm's 5-8.
Yeah.
At best.
So, cool card. Fun, you know, sort of a thought exercise. And as long as you have a good attitude about some of these structural weaknesses, I enjoy playing with this card, but, you know, I just don't think it's quite there, and that's fine.
Yeah, my MTG bank account did not have fun this week.
It's for science, Damon. We're learning. Yeah. We're learning. We're brewing and we're learning.
Yeah.
So I think that kind of puts a bow on Vantress Gargoyle in both Pioneer and Modern. We're going to take another quick break, and then when we come back, we are going to discuss our new card of the week. Stay tuned. We'll be right back.
Welcome back. We're here to discuss our card of the week. This one is Witch's Oven, which is a Throne of Eldraine uncommon. It's one mana for an artifact. Tap, sack a creature. You get to create a food token, and if the sacrifice creature's toughness was 4 or greater, create 2 food tokens. So it's a pretty innocuous little card. It looks like it's kind of meant for draft play. But somehow it put a lot of people into the top 8 of Grand Prix Richmond and was featured in one of the best decks of the most recent Mythic Championship. In particular, this card has found a home in Standard alongside Cauldron Familiar, black for a 1-1 cat, with the text that when a Cauldron Familiar ETBs, it drains the opponent for 1, sack of food, return Cauldron Familiar from your graveyard to the battlefield. And so you get a mini loop. It doesn't go infinite or anything, but if you sack your Cauldron Familiar to the Witch's Oven, you get a food. You can then sack the food to bring back the Cauldron Familiar. In the process, you A, generate a kind of infinite blocker, and B, drain your opponent for 1 once per turn cycle.
Does this combo have an official name that we know of?
I heard this called Kentucky Fried Kitten, because you're baking up this cat. I like that one.
I've heard it called Cat Combo, but that's also the name for Saheeli Combo. I wasn't totally sure, but Kentucky Fried Kitten, we can go with that, sure.
It's a more horrifying name, I guess. It seems like in Standard what's powering these decks up is one thing that benefits from establishing this loop besides just what you get for face value. I've seen this take 2 forms. One is through the card Midnight Reaper, and so every time you sacrifice your Cauldron Familiar, you get to draw a card. You lose a life, of course, but you're gaining life every time you do this loop, and so you're just going up cards every turn. Pretty awesome. And then the other thing I've seen is Trail of Crumbs. One green for an enchantment. When Trail of Crumb ETBs, you get a food token, and then whenever you sacrifice a food, you can pay 1. You look at the top 2 cards of your library, and you reveal a permanent and put it into your hand. It's basically a card draw engine. And the nice part about this Cauldron Familiar Witch's Oven loop is that it doesn't really require any mana. The 1 cost for Trail of Crumbs is just no problem. Once you get it going, the Trail of Crumbs can start finding you more lands if you need them, or any number of creatures or planeswalkers or ovens that you need.
A question that occurs to me, this card is producing food. When I'm thinking about food and Standard, I'm thinking of Gilded Goose and Oko, but those are not the cards you mentioned. So would you say that this is part of the food package, or is it a separate engine that just happens to use food?
It seems more like a separate engine that happens to use food. The Oko engine is all about Gilded Goose to ramp into turn 2 Oko, and then from there turning food into Elks. The Witch's Oven does produce food, but I think it generally you just want to be using that food to bring back the Cauldron Familiar, otherwise you break the loop. It's possible that if you have like multiple, like an excess of Cauldron Familiars, you can convert them into food and kind of keep them dead. Or if you have like extra food from Okos, you can loop these cards faster. I think that they're mostly independent, although I have to say, I haven't really played too much Standard recently.
We're not really a Standard podcast, obviously, but we are now a Pioneer podcast, among other things. So David, I know you've had your eye on this card. We haven't been able to keep it out of your lists. A card that's been creeping into a lot of our sketches that we've been kicking around, some of which we talked about last week even. You've had some further thoughts on what you might want to do with the card, so do you want to take us through some of the sketches that you have in mind?
Yeah, so you guys were teasing me, and I think quite fairly, last week about trying to stick it into these various lists, because we started out with this 2-mana artifact, and it had synergies with the graveyard, so that encouraged me to want to play Emery. Both Witch's Oven and the food it makes are artifacts. So it's a really cheap way to get a cheap Emery. And so I was, you know, all these permutations, I couldn't make it work with Vantress Gargoyle. So what I did, as I recommended earlier in the podcast, was I started cutting Vantress Gargoyle. And then these lists started falling into place. Like I said, I just had to get it out of my system. So you guys are prepping for the Columbus GP, which is Modern. And so I knew you wouldn't have time to really try anything in Modern. So this was kind of my chance to indulge myself and brew around a card that I don't think has a lot of Modern applications, but I think is pretty sweet in Pioneer. So the first list, and this is a list I've already played, and it was awesome. This list is so fun. I highly recommend everyone play it. I've been calling it Sultai Dredge. Basically, what you want to do is just fill up your graveyard and then just start getting all this insane value from it. 4 Cauldron Familiar, 4 Gilded Goose, 4 Stitcher Supplier, 4 Satyr Wayfinder, 3 Scrap Heap Scrounger, 4 Emery Lurker of the Lock, and 4 Prized Amalgam. So basically, the loop with Cauldron Familiar is exactly as Damon described, but I was trying to get more value out of it. So one of the things that makes it so powerful is because it's free, it's very easy to trigger Prize Amalgam over and over again, every turn. So Prize Amalgam and Cauldron Familiar, now these cards are looping if you can get them both in the graveyard. Every turn, they can always block, they can attack into trades, etc. And a card that I found in my testing was Desecrated Tomb, which is super powerful once you have this kind of loop going. Desecrated Tomb is a 3-mana artifact from M19. It says whenever one or more creature cards leave your graveyard, create a 1/1 black bat creature token with flying. It seems pretty innocuous. I don't know if anyone, there's ever a standard list that played this.
I think I opened that in my pre-release as my foil and I threw it away.
All right, well, you should have kept it.
Whoops.
It triggers off of Emry targeting your Scrap Heap Scrounger if you don't want to exile a creature. If you just have Scrap Heap Scrounger exiling another creature, it generates 2 bats. When Cauldron Familiar brings back Prized Amalgam, that's another 2 bats. And then you have a Smuggler's Copy that just kind of ties it all together. It turns your Cauldron Familiars into reasonable attackers. Then you can like sack the familiar after it's crewed the copter, so it's a blocker on their turn. Same with Satyr Wayfinder, turns that into something. And then to kind of keep the whole thing together, you get to play Once Upon a Time, which is an insane card. It helps you find these powerful cards on turn one, or it finds an Emry if you want that.
One thing that we haven't actually brought up yet is that a lot of times, like with combos, once you have like piece A and piece B, further copies of piece A or B aren't really useful. Whereas if you have your first Cauldron Familiar plus Witch's Oven, the second set of them actually just doubles what you're doing. That's actually pretty good because now your draining is just getting to the point where it might actually be threatening their life total.
And it's actually even better than that. You only need one cat. 4 ovens can activate on one cat over and over again. And Emry keeps bringing the ovens back into play. Emry almost is like a tutorable piece to put an oven in the graveyard, then she puts it back into play, and then eventually just get a cat in the graveyard, and so you loop it, loop it, loop it. It's almost impossible for them to kill you, and you just have this crazy late game engine. And then the thing that's fun, I always like to put these kind of jukes into these decks where they bring in all this graveyard hate because they can't really beat it, and then you just get to play like Oko Thief of Crowns now out of the board with Abrupt Decay and other removal. So in these sideboard games, they are playing Rest in Peace or whatever. I've sideboarded out most of the cards that just have no text if they're not graveyard cards, and just Oko beats them.
Well, that seems like it's guaranteed to work.
If you're playing Oko on turn two, it just can't be that wrong.
Back to what you were saying about the ratio of cats and ovens. You're saying that every cat beyond the first is kind of useless. You'll take as many ovens as you can get.
Yes.
But you only need one cat, or you only want one cat. The other cats are just extra.
Yeah, you can set up turns where you get to block with each of them, so it's not nothing, but you don't get any extra drains.
You get one drain per oven per turn cycle.
Yeah, the number of cats beyond one does not change the number of times you get to drain. Each cat beyond the first doesn't do anything other than be an additional blocker, and a lot of times what happens is you can exile those cats to Scrap Heap Scrounger or whatever, if that's what you want.
Yeah, this brings me back to those lists with Safi, Eric's Daughter, and Renegade Rallyer, where you all of a sudden have like a pseudo-infinite creature, and this one is not quite infinite, but it's pseudo indestructible.
It basically functions as a removal spell that drains your opponent for one every turn. You just block their best creature, right? So their Scrap Heap Scrounger gets blocked every turn. And then you just drain them. So against like mono black, this just keeps happening. And then eventually, because their creatures can't block at all, you just get to a point where you bring back a bunch of Prized Amalgams at the end of the turn, drain them a couple times, attack them, and then each cat is another life, and that's the end of the game. And there's just nothing they can do about it. If they can't kill Witch's Oven, it's just borderline inevitability. And because you have all these creatures that keep coming back from the graveyard, and like Emry helps find a Desecrated Tomb, they just can't do anything. It's so great. It just feels so awesome. They play out their whole deck. They have no mana problems. They get to attack you with their Smuggler's Copters and their 2-1 whatevers. And you're just like, nothing you do matters. I'll take this match win quite comfortably. Thank you very much. Now, the one problem is that to win the aggro black mirror matches, people have started the main deck Cletus. So I think you actually need to change your sideboard configuration to deal with that. Cletus is like really hard for this deck to beat. So you need to be able to kill Cletus. Maybe you can't even play Abrupt Decay anymore. Maybe you have to play 4 Assassin's Trophies.
Well, you know what card kills Cletus, right? Oko.
Oh, yeah.
Run the main deck, maybe?
Yeah, or just take your medicine. They play like 1 or 2 Cletus. They got to find it and get to 4 mana.
If you wanted to play the Oko's main deck, what is the least important card? What could they replace?
It's tough because the deck is so synergy-based. My instinct would be to cut 3 of the Citrus Suppliers. It leads to your most explosive draws, which is typically Witch's Oven on turn 1, Citrus Supplier, sack it, so now you have 6 cards in your graveyard. Play Emry for 1, now you have 10 cards in your graveyard. If any of them is a cat, it brings back every other Prized Amalgam that you also milled. But it is the weakest card late in the game. Like, once you kind of have your first cat, if it mills any of those, it's not doing that much extra. It does help find prized amalgams and stuff like that. My instinct would be to cut three Citrus Suppliers and play three Okos. You're adding threes to the deck also, so maybe you need to play a 20th land. You have to tool around with the list. The other card that's surprisingly relevant is the Goose. It's a card that they can kill, but leaving the food around is really important. It's like an extra drain. In the original list, I was trying to play with Feasting Troll. I just could never get up to three food because the cats are so hungry, they ate them all. I eventually replaced it with Desecrated Tomb, which is somehow like way more powerful. Just wins the late game much easier. And all these flying creatures, there's almost nothing that blocks them. So
one question I have is there's basically no removal in the main deck. Can you keep up with the Mono Green Devotion decks?
I'm guessing that your game one matchup is rough. I have not played any of them. I have played Blue Red Phoenix, multiple white blue tempo shells, people playing Autumn Burchett's black green kind of ramp deck from the Invitational, and Mono Black quite a bit. And I have not lost to any of those decks. Those have all been wipeouts. I lost to a Jund list also. So maybe Jund is somehow too powerful. I think Mono Green Devotion is actually going to get out too fast. I don't think you're going to be able to handle Nissa, especially. That's a card that makes so many attackers, you can't actually stop it. So again, maybe that's a reason to go to four Assassin's Trophies in the side.
This is a problem that all these high synergy decks run up against. And here it seems like if you start trimming numbers for any one category of effect, you risk critical failure. Emery stands out as a card that it only really works if you have a density of actual artifacts, not just Gilded Goose, but actual artifacts for Emery to return from the graveyard. But if you start shaving artifacts to like bring in your Okos, your trophies, it's not clear that this deck can support removal in the main deck. You just have to trust that your game one plan will get there, and then you rely on Jukes post-board moving away from the high synergy graveyard angle.
I think that is true to some extent. Like I said, the Citrus Supplier is the easiest card to cut, so if you really wanted to put four sort of interactive cards in, you could put, you know, like three Okos and a Abrupt Decay or Assassin's Trophy. That's probably the move I'd recommend. The Citrus Supplier is not needed. It's not an artifact, and it is just a 1-1. But yeah, you can't over sideboard or under sideboard unless you just accept that like a bunch of these cards get much weaker. That's always the risk when you start bringing in a bunch of cards.
Some numbers I wonder if you could tweak is, could you actually cut a Cauldron Familiar if we only really need to have one active? The thing is that we have a lot of self-mill right now. Even if like your first Emery trigger doesn't mill anything useful, you have these like Wayfinders and Citrus Suppliers to keep milling yourself. And as long as you find one artifact by then, you're good. As long as you find one cat by then, you're good. And so I do wonder if you could cut a Cauldron Familiar, maybe cut the Scrap Heap Scroungers, maybe cut an Emery.
Yeah, I mean, there's lots of numbers you can tool around with. I've always played around with cutting a Familiar, and it's something I did a lot in post-board games, depending on what I wanted to do. Like, I would typically cut the Desecrated Tombs, all four Citrus Suppliers, maybe a Familiar. Those are cards that basically are only good if the graveyard's available to you. So I just assume, let's say they always draw their hate piece, then you'd bring in your, you know, like Okos and everything else and go from there. I'd have to actually like play Mono Green and lose to it a bunch before I was willing to move too far away from this configuration, because it was so powerful against a bunch of these decks that are so successful in the format. And it might be that it wouldn't surprise me if Mono Green was a huge favorite in game one. And then you have to rethink like, how often am I going to play Mono Green? And even like the green blue lists that people have been playing are now playing tons of trample creatures. So is it that entire matchup spread is just so bad for you, you have to accept just losing to them? Or maybe it's an unfixable matchup. That's a very real possibility.
Yeah, if you'd shown me this list 1 year ago, I would have said this is the weirdest pile of cards. This looks like I can't win a game. But now that we've seen how these last few months played out, it looks like the list is full of multi-format stars. Stitcher Suppliers had a breakout year. Even Setter Wayfinder briefly during Hogak Summer.
I still remember the Tarmogoyf with uses a proxy for Setter Wayfinder.
Oh, that's right. In the Pro Tour testing house, they didn't have Wayfinders. They had all these useless Tarmogoyfs.
That was a gem.
The other thing to think about this deck is, just like the modern list, you are just milling, right? So there's Citrus Supplier flips and sacks where you get a bunch of relevant cards in your six, and then there's other times, the one match I've lost, I think I'm 8-1 with this deck, you just don't flip anything good. That's just going to happen. So it has some amount of fail percentage. You mill your Emerys instead of drawing them, and you draw your amalgams instead of milling them. Now you're playing, you know, 3 mana 3/3s, and it doesn't feel good. Mill your Desecrated Tomb and whatever it is. Anytime you're just milling stuff randomly off the top, there's just some percent fail rate just baked into that period. But the deck just feels really smooth. It's a blast to play too. There's a million lines. You just get to keep doing this weird stuff with cats, and it just feels like you have inevitability against decks that can't easily kill all these artifacts. But if they like kill your artifact early, then you play Emery, she gets it back. So they have to have like specifically all this like chained removal to stop the chain.
Yeah, that sounds awesome. So it sounds like you've been winning a lot with this deck already, and I'm excited to hear more about how it plays out. Any tweaks you make going forward. Should we take a look at the next list too?
Yeah, so when Dan and I first kind of started brewing together, Amonkhet was the order of the day. He and I shared a love for a card called Bone Picker.
Ooh.
This card is 3 and a black for a 3/2 flying bird, vulture, right? It has a very important text, which is if a creature died this turn, you can play it for a black mana. Black mana for a 3/2 flying is broken, and 4 mana for a bad phantom monster is not competitive playable. So how can you turn it on? So Dan always said the key is if this card is good, then Fatal Push has to be good. Well, Fatal Push is awesome. Fatal Push kills even cards against ramp decks because they're playing Arboreal Grazer. And not only are they playing Arboreal Grazer, they are once upon a timing in their deck to get Arboreal Grazer. So you somehow always have a target for Fatal Push. So the thought was, all right, 4 Fatal Push, that's not enough to always turn on a Bone Picker. Witch's Oven, this is a card that generates sacrifice every turn. So if we draw Bone Picker turn 2, if we draw Bone Picker turn 4, we just have this Witch's Oven loop happening where it can sacrifice creatures. This list is kind of built around that. So it has 4 Witch's Oven, 4 Bloodsoaked Champion, which is a card, again, that doesn't mind getting sacrificed to Witch's Oven. It comes back into play. 2 Cauldron Familiar, you don't need all 4. 2 Knight of the Ebon Legion, just a powerful 1-drop. 4 Smuggler's Copter, 4 Scrap Heap Scrounger. Those cards have a ton of synergy, obviously, together. 1 Kharizev, Skyship Rider. Every turn you get a Ragavan. After it deals 2 damage, you can sack it for a food and to trigger your Bone Picker.
You baked a Ragavan in the Witch's Oven?
Exactly.
Oh, no.
Chilled monkey brains. I put 1 Heart of Kieran in here because we're playing 4 Bone Picker and 4 Scrap Heap Scrounger. It's actually really easy to crew. And Heart of Kieran is a way to break these Smuggler's Copter mirrors. They basically can never attack you with Smuggler's Copter. And you can attack them if you just have 2 3-power creatures. You just shut down their attack and you get to attack them. And then I wasn't sure what to do with the 3-mana slot, so I put a Midnight Reaper, a Grim High Respects. Dan thought that Midnight Reaper is probably just better because it triggers on itself, and that's probably true. 1 Mayhem Devil, that's a card that's played in the red-black sacrifice deck in Standard, so every time you sacrifice a permanent, so that means when you sacrifice the cat or the food, you get to do a damage anywhere. 2 Unlicensed Disintegrations, we have a ton of artifacts in this deck, and 3-mana kill anything, do 3 to the controller is really powerful. Then 4 Bone Picker and 2 Rankle, Master of Pranks, which is again, like, sweet when you have all these cards you don't mind throwing away. Specifically, you can do your damage, make both players sacrifice creatures. You could sacrifice Ragavan if you wanted to, or a Cauldron Familiar if you have extra food lying around. So you basically just edict your opponent for free. And in the sideboard, you can play Claim the Firstborn. That's a card that's played in some of the standard lists. 1 red mana, take target creature your opponent controls that costs 3 or less and untap it. So you can play it on their Scrap Heap Scrounger, let's say, get in an attack and then turn it into food and then get your cat back and then play a 1-mana Bone Picker.
Yeah, Claim the Firstborn is a 4 of in some of the Rakdos sacrifice lists that you can find in Standard.
And one of the reasons they can play 4 is because the matchup spread in Standard was getting so narrow, right? Green was so dominant. You knew that they always had, you know, a 1-mana creature or the, you know, a 2-mana creature or whatever to take. So they knew that there'd be targets in every matchup, so they could main 4 of those very easily. I don't know that you can do that quite so easily in Pioneer, but maybe you can. Maybe it does become a main deck card. The black-red on turn 1 and 2 is a little rough. There is no fast land for allied colors yet, so I really privilege black spells cheap on the curve, and there's only red spells with a single red pip as you kind of go up to the 2 and 3-mana cost.
This list is very near and dear to my heart. It reminds me so much of that mono black list from Amonkhet Standard that Dave was referring to. I played that deck a lot. This was after Smuggler's Copter had been banned from Standard, so the vehicle of choice was Heart of Kieran, which was a 3 or 4 of in the deck. To crew it, Bone Picker was really the star. Also, I was playing these various 3-mana, 3/2s. Ruin Raider was one that actually performed quite well. Even though it's a little bit of a nombo with Bone Picker, Ruin Raider says that at the beginning of your end step, if you attacked with any creatures that turn, you get to do the Dark Confidant ability where you reveal your top card, lose life equal to its casting cost, and put that in your hand. Now there's a lot of competition at the 3 slot. You talked about the Grim Horror Specs, the Midnight Reaper, the Mayhem Devil. So I'm not sure that Ruin Raider fits, and then even going higher on the curve, Rankle Master of Pranks. But some of the basic concepts from that Mono Black list are still alive and well in Pioneer. The Mono Black Aggro, which seems to be the top deck, or one of the top decks in the metagame, relies heavily on these black 1-drops crewing vehicles on turn 2. Night Market Lookout is a 4 of, I think, in a lot of these decks. now that Smuggler's Copter only requires a crew of one. So I like the basic curve here. I like the concept. I think it seems like it's lean, it has a good aggressive curve, it has reach, and it has a higher density of flying than most lists will find because the bone pickers function as these Delver of Secrets.
Yeah, the list looks pretty strong. I do wonder if you could just cut the red entirely. You only have 4 red cards main deck. I'm not sure that your mana base will be super stable to support that in Pioneer.
You could probably find cards within Mono Black to fill out the list. I guess it remains to be seen how important the red removal is. I think Unlicensed Disintegration is an intriguing option for sure. And then these Claim the Firstborns, Abrades, Dreadbores.
Yeah, the other card that I'm actually really interested in the sideboard to play red is Crumble to Dust. I think the Field of Dead decks are seeing a rise, and this lets you play like a 4 mana card that kind of disables plan A of those decks. If that's not worth it though, yeah, then maybe you do just want to, I mean, Unlicensed Disintegration is something you get to play, so that's something you have to play, but you might be right, Damon. The splash might not be worth it.
If it was a opposite color pair splash, I would be more inclined, but allied pair colors are sometimes tricky.
Yeah.
I'm also not sure that a deck like this really cares about the Field of the Dead. Like, in theory, it's supposed to go a little bit under that deck.
Or fly over it with the Smuggler's Copters and the Bone Pickers.
And the Rankles, yeah.
Maybe it doesn't matter. And this does have a lot more flying than the Mono Black deck, for instance. A really cool interaction is that Bone Picker, again, the casting cost is so relevant. The 4 CC. Mono Black cannot proactively activate its own Fatal Pushes.
Hmm.
If you're just very selective about when you kill their creatures when they don't have mana up, you can make sure they never ever get to kill creatures of yours that cost 3 or more. This is something that if you're a Pioneer player, you have to be very conscious of when you decide to kill creatures and when not to. The Mono Black deck cannot actively turn on its Fatal Push. There's no card in its entire list that does that. So you have total control over if they can kill a 3 or 4 mana creature or not.
I didn't realize that. Two benchmarks that I found for whether Bone Picker is a good card are, is there like a shock in the format that is widely played? And secondly, is it safe to go down a card, essentially, like throw away a creature to play it for 1 mana just for a burst of speed? Like, instead of waiting for a Fatal Push target to materialize to actually just throw away one of your own creatures. I was using Walking Ballista for that purpose, but here we have the Oven. Do you feel, David, that the conditions are right in Pioneer for that? Bone Picker will not just die to a wild slash?
Yeah, shocks have been really chased out of the format. When you look at all these lists, I think the format right now is chased shock out of the format. The most powerful list, we just listed them all. None of them are playing red at all. Mono red is not very powerful. It's just too slow. It's actually like a much worse aggro deck than the mono green stompies or blue green stompy. Only Gruul plays shock, and there wasn't any of those in the top 16 of the last 2 PTQs. Obviously, Pioneer is a big format. You can play all kinds of crazy decks in the queues, but I never see shock played against me. It meets that one marker. The Witch's Oven thing is, I guess, remains to be seen. The Witch's Oven Cauldron Familiar Loop helps in these mirror matches against Mono Black. You just basically gum up the ground and win in the air. Is it powerful enough against decks that are trying to go over the top of you? Some of these more controlling lists? That's unknown, but the fact that you get to play all these flying creatures is good, as you guys just said, against the sort of big deck in the format, the late game deck that's just putting a bunch of zombies on the ground. This is your chance to just sneak in a bunch of damage at the end.
My last question, I guess, is Witch's Oven in particular, is it a 4 of here, or what can we expect to get out of it throughout the course of the game? The Cauldron Familiar combo provides a little bit of drain and a chump blocker, you're saying. Beyond that, I don't think we need the food so much in this list.
Yeah, I tend to agree. I don't know that you'd ever need the food. Obviously, it helps if you're racing, but this deck doesn't have that much mana, and so you could imagine a lot of food just lying around with nothing to do with it. I'm not sure if there's a solution to that. If there's a, maybe you could play less Witch's Ovens. That's very reasonable. You could replace Witch's Ovens with Walking Ballista in some number, so you have what you're talking about, sort of a proactive way to kill a mana elf and get a creature dead. I don't know if the format is quite conducive enough to just playing Walking Bliss to ping them for 1 just to get a cheap Bone Picker. That seems a little too ambitious for me. You can definitely tool around with the numbers there.
Yeah, I mean, we're trying to learn about Witch's Oven, and certainly like the number of Witch's Oven and Cauldron Familiars to have in a list like this is definitely an interesting one to resolve.
When you look for sacrifice outlets in Pioneer, there's almost nothing else. It's basically Witch's Oven or Bust.
Yes.
So we have the right card for the job, if sacrificing is what we want to do. There are cards that we have in small quantities right here, like Mayhem Devil, Midnight Reaper, that might really want a lot of sacrificing, or it could just be a support card for something more like a beatdown plan, or it could pivot between roles depending on how the matchup plays out. A lot to learn about this from getting on the queues, I think.
Definitely.
Is Priest of Forgotten Gods at all something in this deck as another sac outlet?
Yeah, I think that card goes in a list that is much less aggressive. I think it's a card that maybe has a place in like a cool mid-rangey shell. But if I'm playing Bone Picker, I don't think those synergize well.
Fair.
Priest of Forgotten Gods is a four of in a lot of the Rakdos sacrifice lists.
Yes.
In Standard.
And they combo it with cards like the 3-mana Chandra, so that provides two bodies right there for Priest to turn into value.
Combos with Claim the Firstborn. There's a lot of competition at the 2 slot in Pioneer because of Smuggler's Copter, Herd of Kira, and Scrap Heap Scrounger.
Yeah, and once you go down the Bone Picker route, you're kind of declaring your intention that you're wanting to attack with these three power creatures. I do think that Priest of Forgotten Gods has a place, though, in Pioneer. It seems like it's on the cusp of playability. There's definitely a shell somewhere with that card. That would not surprise me.
And I think if you wanted to build a slower deck built around these sacrifice synergies, you could still play Bone Pickers in them. More like that modern deck you're talking about, Damon, where the Jace's Phantasm is not your turn one play. It's your turn 3 or 4 play where you either stabilize with it and eventually kill them. It's a very efficient play at 3/2 flying Death Touch for one.
Right.
That style of deck, I think the Witch's Oven providing food could buy a lot of time. That's not this particular build, but I think that's another direction that you could explore with a similar set of cards, payoffs, and enablers.
And again, dodges Raska, dodges Abrupt Decay. Forecasting cost is like hauntingly relevant for Bone Picker.
So back to the oven then. Do you want to talk about some of the other ideas you've been kicking around?
I'll just go through these quick. We don't want to get too deep in the weeds on both of these lists, but another thing I was thinking is, all right, we've got this Witch's Oven, so we're sort of incentivized to play Claim the Firstborn. What are other sort of free sacrifice effects? Well, I've been kicking around a list last week that was playing like Rekindling Phoenix, so Witch's Oven is already pretty good with that. If they ever tap out, you just get a free food. You protect Rekindling Phoenix from exile effects or
bounce effects.
Yeah, bounce effects or elk effects. That list was already playing Emerge Creatures. Well, Emerge Creature is another sort of sacrifice outlet. So the list I have and Daniel posted is a Grixis Emerge list, but literally Grixis is only a name. There's just one Cauldron Familiar. Hopefully our plan is to just loot it at some point in the game because we're playing Cathartic Reunion and Izzet Charm. We're also trying to put Kozilek's Return in the graveyard, and then we have 6 Eldrazi that emerge that will trigger this Kozilek's Return, so that'll sweep the board. And they can either sacrifice for Kindling Phoenix, they can sacrifice Flaming Phoenix, but we're playing Claim the Firstborn, so we could take their creature, sacrifice it. It reduces the cost of our Elder Deep Fiend by 3 or our Vexing Scuttler. And in the case of Scuttler, we get back Claim the Firstborn. So they're incentivized to not play another creature for us to take, or we'll take that too.
You gotta tell me about this card, Vexing Scuttler. This is not one that many people know about.
Vexing Scuttler was the kid sister of the Elder Deep Fiend days in the Temurge list. Its emerge cost is 6 and a blue, or Elder Deep Fiends is 5 blue-blue. Vexing Scuttler is 6 and a blue emerge. The emerge mechanic, for people who don't know, is to pay its emerge cost, you sacrifice a creature in play, and then you reduce the emerge cost by the casting cost of that creature. So Claim the Firstborn can only take a 3 CC or less, so let's say it's taking a 3 mana creature. Now the emerge cost of Vexing Scuttler is 3 and a blue. When it's cast, you get to return an instant or sorcery from your graveyard to your hand. And it's a 4/5 body, and it also triggers Kozilek's Return. So you set up this mini 2-turn loop where you get to claim the Firstborn, take their creature. You can sacrifice the land that goes and searches out another Eldrazi. So you've sort of cast this spell, killed their creature, and now you've gotten 2 cards back to your hand. You've gotten to Claim the Firstborn and another Vexing Scuttler if you wanted, or an Elder Deep Fiend.
I love the interaction between Witch's Oven and Rekindling Phoenix. Rekindling Phoenix was, at various times in his standard life, just the end boss of Mono Red. Lava Coil got printed eventually. People found ways to work around it. But it's basically unkillable if they're not playing specific kinds of interaction. Now, that kind of interaction does exist in the format. You mentioned Oko, Reflector Mage, and Brazen Borrower are both pretty common in these blue-white decks. There are cards that make Rekindling Phoenix feel bad and look bad, but somehow, if you have a Witch's Oven, it suddenly looks great again. I'm optimistic that just that combo in particular unlocks the power of Rekindling Phoenix and takes away some of the weaknesses of a deck built around it.
And by the way, just for people out there, if you are casting Murderous Rider or Brazen Borrower and targeting a creature with Witch's Oven in play, your opponent can choose to make that instant or sorcery not resolve. Your creature will not go on an adventure. It will be gone forever. People played into that all the time. I don't think they kind of realize that interaction. Your adventure spell has to resolve in order to kind of get your value out of it. So if someone has a Witch's Oven up, you just can't cast Petty Theft, for instance, until they tap the oven.
That's a good good point.
I let multiple murderous riders resolve on my spells because I wanted them to take 2 damage, and then I killed them on the following turn. But that was just out of the goodness of my heart.
Have you considered the card Merfolk Secret Keeper for this deck?
Don't know what that card is.
The adventure one that mills 4.
Oh, yeah. I started out thinking that card was going to be sweet in all kinds of lists at various points, and it has not impressed me at all.
It's a mill enabler, usually a self-mill enabler. Then you get this bonus 0/4 creature. A deck like this has the lightest of graveyard synergies, the Cauldron Familiar, the Kozilek's Return primarily. You could play more. It's also a extra body for Emerge, and it's 2 foods off the Witch's Oven if you wanted that. I think in order to make that worth it, you'd have to find room for more stuff that comes out of the graveyard. Right now, there's the Flame Wakes and the Kozilek's Return.
I think that card would be good in a deck with the Feasting Troll as a way to put the troll in the graveyard on the front half and then give you 2 foods on the second half. That's actually kind of interesting.
Yeah, I think that was tried in Standard briefly before it was determined there was too much else going on in Standard.
Well, maybe it's unlocked now that Oko has been chased away. That's more of a speculative list. You know, the first 2 lists are the ones I'm really excited to try. This one has some potential. And then 1 quick one. So we're bringing back our Cauldron Familiar over and over again, and it's giving us 1 life and draining our opponent for 1 life. So how can we turn that interaction into something that's more, right? So with the Sultai list, we took the fact that it's coming out of the graveyard, we had all these other cards that were benefiting from that. This list that I'm proposing benefits from the life gain. So another card on 1 that gives you life every turn is Night Market Lookout. What is a card that benefits from gaining life is Ajani's Pridemate. Each of these life gain triggers turns Ajani's Pridemate into a bigger and bigger creature. In addition, Murderous Rider, which is a card some of these lists want to play anyway, has lifelink on the back end. So when, after you kill their creature, Planeswalker, you resolve your Murderous Rider. If it blocks or attacks, again, it triggers your Ajani's Pridemate. Ethersphere Harvester is a card I think is really underplayed. Again, it dominates Smuggler's Copter, so it wins all those battles in the air, and it also can be crewed for just 1 power, which a lot of these decks are playing lots of, and we are playing many of because we have 4 Cauldron Familiar for Night Market Lookout. And then at the top end, we have 2 Kalidus. Like I said, that's already being played as a Mirror Breaker in these Mono Black matchups online. That has lifelink. And then, just to be fun, we have 2 Crested Sunmare. That triggers on every end step if you gained a life. So let's say you crew up a Smuggler's Copter on your turn with your Night Market Lookout. That gives you a life. You play your Crested Sunmare after combat. You get a horse at the end of your turn. And then on their turn, you can put a cat into play. It triggers again. So each turn sequence, you can get 2 5/5 horses that are indestructible.
And I thought Titania was busted in Legacy.
Exactly.
This deck looks hilarious and sweet.
Yeah, I'm not sure how good this deck is. It's probably just a worse version than Mono Black. So nobody needs to say that to me. I understand. We're not playing 4 Thoughtseize. That's an insane card, and we're not playing it. It's a card you could play, but this deck is again, focused more on the synergy. So like Dan says, if you start taking out the synergistic pieces, you kind of start having to make a series of decisions that push you back to Mono Black. It's just a fun idea to try to kind of like turn on Ajani's Pridemate. Just an idea to kick around.
I'm intrigued by this. I wonder how good Ajani's Pridemate is. There are more copies of this creature in the card pool. There's a black version of it that has flying for 3 mana. And there's also the Ajani Planeswalker that has a minus ability to create token copies of Ajani's Pridemate. So if you really felt like that was a thing to be doing, you could play more of those. There's also a card called Lone Rider from
Eldritch Moon
that will transform at the end of your turn if you've gained 3 life during the turn, which is exactly how much a food gives you. So if you wanted to have more of these payoff creatures, lean even harder into the synergies. There are cards you could explore in a shell like this.
Yeah, Lone Rider's a sweet one. It's definitely a card I've tooled around with. We even had some speculative brews in Modern that I was trying to sort of adapt to Pioneer, so at some point we'll break those out maybe, but I think there's stuff to explore in this list. You know, I don't know how good it will be or not be, but stuff to consider. It's almost Thanksgiving. You know, it's time to fire up the ovens and, you know, see what kind of pie we're going to get out of it. I'm a pumpkin pie man myself, but we'll see what Ajani's Pridemate likes.
Yeah, we got cats and crabs and octopus to cook.
Can I just ask you last question? Is there any potential for a Witch's Oven in Modern?
I mean, I never say never because all these people out here are so creative. They just come up with ideas I never would have thought of. It just seems a little too weak to me. The fact that, one, there's just Karn the Great Creator in a bunch of decks that just neutralizes it. It's not like you even have main deck advantage. They're just playing this as part of their proactive plan to win, so it shuts down your card. And then this like looping 1 life thing is just so weak in the face of all these infinite combos. So one thing Pioneer doesn't have is all these decks that just basically win on turn 4 or 5 for sure. Looping 1 life gain and then they resolve Valakut in a Primeval Titan or 7-mana Karn or whatever. There's just so many ways that you die, and these sort of fair games that dominate Pioneer, where people are playing the board with 2-mana creatures that are, you know, slightly under-costed for their power and toughness, which is kind of the magic I've been enjoying playing. I've been loving Pioneer. That's a place where the Witch's Oven Cauldron Familiar combo literally is a removal spell functionally that also is draining them for a turn. You need that kind of interaction to be worthwhile. And even the sort of dredge possibilities, it's just so much weaker than all these cards that have the word dredge printed on them. It's hard for me to imagine the card has enough power in terms of these synergies to compete in Modern, which is, as you guys know, just so powerful, so streamlined, so cutthroat.
I hear what you're saying. I'm mostly interested in the sacrifice ability. There are sacrifice outlets. There are other options for sacrificing creatures in Modern. Viscera Seer and Kyrian Feeder at 1-mana, Ultra Dementia at 2-mana. When I compare the Witch's Oven to those, it's not totally clear which one is better. So the Kyrian Feeder and the Viscera Seer are both vulnerable to removal. The thing that they give you for sacrificing a creature is slightly worse than a food, I think. So you get a Scry 1 for Viscera Seer, you get a +1/+1 counter for Kyrian Feeder. However, those creatures plus the Ultra Dementia both allow you to sacrifice unlimited number of times, so they feed into these combo decks. Whereas Witch's Oven is a tap, so you only get to sacrifice one thing. The only scenario in which it's the best sacrifice outlet is one in which, A, you're interested in artifacts, and you only need to sacrifice one thing some of the time. You're not trying to do a loop. That being said, it's hard to remove, it's very cheap. It is an artifact that produces more artifacts, which, as we've seen in the last couple of months, is actually a pretty good strategy in Modern. So I'm not totally writing the card off, but it would probably lean more into broken artifact synergies and sacrifice synergies than the specific Cauldron Familiar creature angles that we've seen in Pioneer.
Yeah, my intuition is that it's only really good with Cauldron Familiar compared to the other sac outlets you're mentioning.
Well, I was thinking, let's say you had a Gilded Goose. That's a creature and a food. With the Witch's Oven, it's actually two foods. If you really just wanted to pump out a lot of artifacts, the Witch's Oven is a decent way to do that, especially sacrificing creatures that came back from the graveyard, like a Blood Ghast could give you a food every turn. What you would do with those foods is a little bit less clear. Salvage Titan is the card that I have my eye on. I haven't quite figured that out yet. I don't have a list to propose for this, but it's just something I'm thinking about.
I mean, it's true that just a blank artifact is so much more valuable in Modern because Mox Opal is allowed to exist, and so is Urza, and so they both turn them into pseudo Moxes.
And the oven turns Urza into two delicious pies.
I can't imagine wanting to sack Urza unless it was in response to a removal spell, but yeah, sure, absolutely.
Well, sometimes you draw two of them and they are legendary.
Sometimes you spin Urza and you find another Urza on top. That happens all the time. Now you get some foods. In any case, just some food for thought. We'll fire it up in the oven and see what comes out. All right, this looks sweet. We will be back next week. David will perhaps have some Pioneer results, and Damon and I may have a, I don't know, trophy report to report back on from Columbus.
Yeah, good luck in Columbus, guys.
Thanks.
Yeah, thanks. Be seeing you soon, Dan.
Yeah.
Take care, Dave.
Take care.
That'll do it for this edition of the Faithless Brewing Podcast. You can find all of the deck lists from today's show in the episode description of your podcast player. Faithless Brewing is a listener-supported show. If you like what you heard and would like to contribute directly, you can join our Patreon at patreon.com/faithlessbrewing. All patrons get access to our Discord channel and other cool rewards. You can also find us on Twitter at faithlessmtg. Email us, faithlessbrewing@gmail.com, or our homepage, faithlessbrewing.podbean.com. We rely on brewers like you to help us improve the show and bring you better content. So give us a follow, tell a friend, and we will see you next week.